dismally, because at that moment the hot flush of joy in her breast went surging through every part of her. Montana grinned.
Patanay has confessed to the thefts.
Is that all?
Of course not. One thing at a time.
That's what I always say.
Are you going to keep interrupting me, or do you want to hear how the investigation stands? Make up your mind. I must get back in a minute.
Calm down, Vito. Well?
Montana swirled his espresso instead of stirring it with a spoon and gulped it down.
Patanay has been sitting in an interview room since this morning. He was a bit uncooperative to begin with, but he's been babbling like a brook ever since we confronted him with the evidence.
What evidence?
Traces of a dead body in his car.
Hallelujah!
Poldi cried delightedly.
The tire tracks at the mine fit his car, Montana summarized. So we searched it and found traces of a dead body in the boot, and also traces of Valentino's blood identical to those at the crime scene.
Has he confessed?
Only to the thefts as yet, but he claims they weren't thefts proper. Allegedly, everything had been agreed with the owner of the houses in question.
Mimi Pastorella di Belfiore, have you questioned him?
What do you think? The noble signore didn't deny it. And to be honest, he seems a bit gaga. Keeps talking about some German poet.
Hölderlin.
Is he well known?
A genius from Tübingen who went mad. Did Mimi say anything else about the case?
No. Where the thefts are concerned, there'll be a separate investigation to determine whether they constituted a crime at all. In my opinion, Mimi Pastorella is just senile.
He did well out of the deal, though.
He can do what he likes with his own property. He's guilty of tax evasion at most. Anyway, Valentino worked for Patanay, but Patanay denies that Valentino ever blackmailed him.
Poldi thought for a moment.
Then why was he so keen on the gate lion?
A knee-jerk reaction, he claims. Like the knockout drops in your wine. He wants to apologize to you, by the way.
Smarmy devil. Did he say what he and Russo were arguing about in the car park?
Outstanding bills for an extension he'd built. Russo has confirmed this.
He has he? Well, well. Be that as it may, with this level of evidence, Patanay may as well give up.
Montana spooned the remains of the sugar out of his espresso cup.
He vehemently denies having murdered Valentino.
Let him. The weight of the evidence is overwhelming.
Montana evidently needed sugar. He bit off some of his marzipan mandarin.
Delicious. Really fresh. Try some.
The evidence is overwhelming, Vito, isn't it?
Pretty well. We'll have to wait for the DNA comparison with the traces from the scene of the crime. The murder weapon is still missing. Patanay also claims that he lent the car to Valentino the day before his death. He found it back outside his house the next morning, so he assumed all was well.
And he said nothing all this time. I ask you, Vito, does he have an alibi?
No.
There you are, then. Have you arrested anyone else for the thefts?
Should we?
I'm only asking.
Poldi?
I'm only asking. Has Patanay at least admitted killing the cat?
Montana shook his head.
He denies that, too.
He's a liar. What about the skeleton in the cistern?
Well, that's the next thing. Clearly a young woman that we haven't managed to identify her yet. Forensics estimate that she could have been lying down there for 30 to 50 years. We're going through all the missing persons records, but without a DNA comparison it won't be easy.
A cold case,
Poldi exclaimed eagerly. Montana pulled a face.
It'll be difficult to nail anyone for murder after such a long time. But we discovered the dried-up remains of some flowers beside the skeleton.
Flowers?
Roses.
You mean someone knew the woman was lying down there, and threw some roses onto her?
Yes. Within the last few years, too. Some of the roses were relatively well preserved. Romantic, eh?
What does Mimi say about it? He owns the mine, after all.
He was flabbergasted. But he claims he never bothered about the mine. only ever went there once with his father as a child. Somehow, I don't think there's any connection with Valentino's murder.
What about the new padlock? You think that's a coincidence too, Vito?
Montana sighed. We're working on it, okay?
Poldi bit off some of the marzipan fruit, allowed the sweet almond paste to dissolve on her tongue, and cogitated.
Troubled by a triviality as impalpable as the confectionery in her mouth. Just a triviality like a distant, irritating clicking sound one can't locate or turn off. An unpleasant smell that pursues one throughout the day, or a question mark without a question. It meant she'd overlooked something. Only a triviality, but the vital piece in the puzzle. Montana glanced at his watch. I must go.
So what was the bad news?
Asked Poldi. Oh, yes, the bad news. Montana drew a deep breath. I believe him. Paternay, I mean.
Poldi tried not to show that this didn't surprise her somehow.
Why?
He suddenly looked even wearier. I can't tell you. Call it instinct. There's certainly enough evidence to charge him, even without a confession. Valentino's body was transported in a car, Valentino put the squeeze on him, Paternay is a thief who drugged you and organized a break-in at your house. The chief wants the case closed as quickly as possible.
But you don't believe Paternay's the murderer?
It's just a feeling, as I say.
How long have you been doing this job, Vito?
36 years.
Has your instinct ever let you down?
Innumerable times.
He ran a hand nervously over his face and beard, as if trying to wipe off an annoying film of something. His bright green eyes looked dull, almost grey.
Poldi could tell he hadn't slept much in the previous 2 days. I really have to go now, Poldi.
And I'd really like to kiss you now.
A little colour came back into the pale green eyes, but his smile remained pained. Poldi construed this as a crystal-clear sign of mixed feelings, and she knew a thing or two about those.
Let's have a talk when the case is closed, shall we?
Oh, Vito.
He wanted to go. Couldn't wait to return to his office in the prefecture. The familiar world of investigation and lies. Poldi pictured his lovely colleague waiting for him there, not only impatiently but, with a bit of luck, consumed with jealousy. But before he went, he drew Poldi to him and kissed her.
What do you mean by kissed? I cut in at this point in September before she could go on. Details, please.
You mean that interests you now? You're usually so bashful about such things.
And you're usually more precise.
All right, how did he kiss you? With tongue or without? Did he take your breath away? Was he greedy, desperate, frantic as a drowning man? Was it an explosion of sensuality, a bit of sophisticated foreplay, or more of a cursory peck on the mouth? Were his lips dry or moist? Did his beard tickle? Did the kiss seem to last an eternity, or was it agonizingly brief? Did his breath smell fresh or just stale? I mean, did you click?
Poldi looked at me intently. She might have been looking at a cute little hamster which has unexpectedly performed a new trick in its cage.
In the first place, she said, you obviously don't have a clue about kissing, or you wouldn't ask such daft questions. Secondly, the man is a detective chief inspector and a Sicilian, a sexual force of nature, in other words. Thirdly,
Poldi closed her eyes and opened them again.
Thirdly, he tasted of Sicily. Bitter from the coffee, sweet from the marzipan, sour from cigarettes and salty from the sadness and lies he has to put up with every day, from suppressed passion and the pain of falling between two stools again and again. His beard tickled, but in a way that went right through me. It's like walking through a field of corn in summer and feeling you're alive. He smelt sweaty the way a hard-working man smells, of warm skin and a trace of aftershave,
of longing and relief that he's back with you and can be himself once more. It was a kiss that tells you, as plain as can be, I want you, and I don't give a damn about anyone else. And at the same time, it was a farewell kiss that suddenly tears itself away from your lips before they can say, come, one that severs all the ties between you and rips your heart out as well. It was that sort of kiss. Is that good enough for you?
If anyone knew something about love, Sicily, and farewells, it was my Auntie Poldy. On the other hand, she didn't intend to take that farewell kiss lying down.
Piacere, grazie e buona giornata.
Or file away her heart and give up the commissario just like that. Neither him nor the case.
Why not?
Because my Auntie Poldy had the feeling she was arriving in Sicily at last. Back home again, she sat bolt upright on the sofa, composed herself for a moment, shut her eyes, trying to forget about the kiss, and instead remember the triviality that had so worried her in the cafe. It wasn't easy because of the whiz-bangs that kept going off in the church square. Bang! More and more exasperated, Poldy rooted around in her recollections like someone trying to dislodge a morsel of salami stuck in the gap between two teeth. No use. So she did what she had been taught to do when meditating at the ashram. She took the unresolved triviality by the scruff of the neck, like someone teaching a puppy to sit, and put it back on its blanket.
And stay there till you tell me the answer yourself.
Boom! The unresolved triviality winced at the next bang, whimpered a little, gazed meekly up at Poldy and tried to slink off its blanket. Poldy drew a deep breath, grabbed it by the scruff of the neck again, and gently, patiently put it back.
Maybe you can tell me why Vito's bad news didn't surprise me. I mean, Paterne is a thief, a fence, and he damn nearly killed me with knockout drops. He's got a motive, and there are masses of clues that seem to incriminate him. So why have I suddenly stopped thinking he murdered Valentino?
The unresolved triviality looked up at Poldy attentively.
Good dog, she said. All right, let's assume it wasn't Paterne. What does that mean? It means I'm wrong about the murder motive, right?
The unresolved triviality wagged its tail.
Aha! And it also means that the only candidates left are Valerie and Mimi, or Russo, right?
The unresolved triviality wearily rested its chin on its paws and dozed off. Poldy didn't know what to make of that. She opened her eyes. The house was hushed and cool. A tap was dripping in the bathroom. The shutters creaked gently in the midday sunlight. The whiz-bangs had temporarily ceased, it seemed. Poldy could hear Signora Anzalone talking to someone outside in the Via Baronessa. She could only hear her neighbour's voice, though, not that of the other person, who was either saying nothing or speaking very softly. She got up from the sofa, intending to peek through the shutters. Just then the doorbell rang. She froze, momentarily overcome by the notion that outside her door were two unshaven, track-suited thugs with shades and silencers, and just beyond them, Signora Anzalone lying on the ground in a pool of blood. But then she heard her neighbour say something.
"Yes, yes, she's in. I saw her come home a while back."
She sounded encouraging and familiar somehow. Not like someone talking to mafia hitmen. Poldy opened the front door. It was sad Signora Cocuzza from the bar. Still wearing her white apron over a grey skirt and a pink T-shirt dusted with flour, she looked shorter and more frail than she usually did behind her till, almost transparent, but very erect. Poldy had only ever seen her from the waist up before. It now struck her that, despite the sorrow etched into her features, Signora Cocuzza seemed to glow as if there burned deep inside her a light that flickered through all the shadows in her heart. But that might just have been the midday sunlight in the Via Baronessa. Signora Cocuzzo was holding out a small package tied up with ribbon. It gave off a delectable smell of fried food.
"I don't mean to intrude, Donna Poldina."
"You aren't intruding in the least."
"I wanted to thank you again for the mushrooms. They were quite delicious. Do you like arancini?"
"I'd sell my nephew for a few of your arancini, signora."
A hint of a trace of a ghost of a smile.
"They're still hot. Two with ragu and two with mozzarella, but they'll keep till tomorrow."
Poldi took the package and stepped aside.
"Do come in."
She had expected a shy refusal, but the sad signora needed no second bidding.
"I really don't want to intrude, though."
"Nonsense! We'd eat the arancini together and wash them down with a couple of cold beers, what do you say?"
When Poldi had closed the front door, Signora Cocuzza turned to her.
"Are you still looking for Valentino's murderer?"
Slumbering on its blanket, somewhere at the back of Poldi's mind, the unresolved triviality sighed in the throes of a restless dream.
"I certainly am."
The sad signora nodded.
"Good. Then I may have some information for you."
She fixed Poldi with a steady gaze.
"I know who the girl in the cistern was."
Chapter 14 Tells of beauty and death, and of what Signora Cocuzza was unable to forget. The Virgin Mary discloses her secret, and is celebrated with fireworks and a procession. Poldi draws her conclusions and sets a thoroughly ingenious trap for Valentino's murderer. Things don't go according to plan, unfortunately, and she has to continue her interrogation on the brink of an abyss. The story Signora Cocuzza told Poldi might be described as a Sicilian ballad about beauty and death. It went as follows. Long, long ago, in the small town of Caruba on the slopes of Etna, overlooking the eastern shores of Sicily, there lived a very beautiful girl named Marisa Pulisi. She was the only child of humble agricultural labourers who spent their whole existence toiling away for the elderly nobleman who owned the lemon orchard they tended. Despite their poverty, however, Marisa's parents were very happy, because Marisa's beauty and her cheerful, outgoing nature constituted the totality of their wealth and happiness. When she laughed, the sun rose, buds opened, and hearts beat faster. When she cursed, the sky grew dark, Etna fell silent, and angelic trumpets sounded the Armageddon. Marisa blossomed early. Endowed with the curves of a grown woman, even at the age of 12, she aroused envy and lust in equal measure. When she was around, her classmates clasped their flat bosoms in despair. As for the men of the town, young and old, they dreamt of the forbidden apples of paradise whenever she walked past. When little Marisa attended mass on Sundays with her little white dress and her beloved Monchichi bag, every head turned to look at her. It was not long before word spread throughout the district that Caruba was home to a growing girl whose beauty could blind cyclops and drive men insane. And so it turned out. By the time she was 16, Marisa's name could be seen all over the place, carved on trees and pews and sprayed on walls. Marisa ti amo. Marisa ti voglio. Marisa vita mia. Her skin was as luminously pale as ricotta with honey, and soft as the peaches from Santa Venerina, for Marisa shunned the sun. Her body harbored a multitude of shadowy dimples, secret places and hollows that cried out for tender exploration. Her dark hair fell to her shoulders like ancient streams of lava, and her turquoise eyes were as big and mysterious as the lagoons of Tindari, the gold flecks in them resembling the glitter of morning sunlight on the sea. Her lips, which were always slightly parted as if to utter a major question or a minor reproach, were as full and red and glossy as cherries from Sant'Alfio. Everything, but everything about Marisa was soft and rounded and graceful. Her arms and legs were firm and strong from housework. Her hips resembled those of an ancient fertility goddess, Persephone, perhaps, and she shook the world's equilibrium with every step she took. And, oh, her bosom. A yearning shore. A quiet bay between two wonderful hills visible from afar. A place where a lost fisherman could safely drop anchor and drowse away his sorrows. All in all, it must be said that Marisa had been created by a generous god. Created for love. Marisa thought so anyway. And she was ready to bestow love, laughter, and pleasure with equal generosity. But not on the first poor wretch who came along. In order to attain true perfection, however, all beauty requires the minor flaws that alone can render perfection discernible, and our own mediocrity, our oversized noses, crooked teeth, and meager breasts, tolerable. In Marisa's case, they were some insignificant skin blemishes, feet that were on the big side, and a predilection for bad language. Above all, though, lack of intelligence. For all her beauty, it must alas be said that Marisa Pulisi was rather stupid. She began to be overly proud of her beauty, flirting and boasting of her effect on boys and men. She needed admiration and adoration as gods need nectar and junkies need a fix, yet she gave all her admirers the brush off. Well, most of them at least, because her heart wasn't made of stone. She was young, and her passionate nature needed an outlet. However, she was firmly resolved not to squander the gift of her beauty, but to use it as a ticket to happiness. And to Marisa, happiness meant a house with a fitted kitchen and a cleaning woman, a fur coat, and a permanent pass to the smartest Lido in Catania. In short, Marisa Pulisi was dead set on marrying a rich man. No one less than a dottore or an avvocato would be considered, and it seems that a suitable candidate soon presented himself. At this point in her Sicilian ballad, Signora Cocuzza herself appeared on the scene. A shy and sickly young girl in those days, she was occasionally taken into Marisa's confidence. Marisa confessed to her friend that a young man from a good family was not only passionately in love with her, nay, worshipped her, but also wrote her ardent love letters. This appealed to her, because none of her other swains had ever thought to do so. She further disclosed that she had to keep the whole affair a strict secret, and only met her admirer on the sly because his father sternly opposed their liaison. They would soon reach the point of no return, however. She would then tell her friend everything, and, of course, appoint her a bridesmaid. 2 weeks later, Marisa Pulisi disappeared without trace, somewhere near the Provinciale between Caruba and Ashiriali. She was never seen again until the day Vito Montana opened the cistern of an old sulphur mine fittingly named Femina Morta. Poldi listened to the whole ballad in silence, sipping her beer while it was still cool and never once interrupting Signora Cocuzza.
"It broke her parents' hearts, naturally,"
said the sad Signora.
"Mine too. I'd never forgotten Marisa. Yesterday, when I heard that the police had found a woman's skeleton at Femina Morta, near Piazza Amarina, I realized it could only be hers."
Poldi nodded.
"True. But how come you already know of the discovery?"
Signora Cocuzza made a weary gesture.
"One hears things."
"Didn't the police investigate Marisa's disappearance?"
"Yes, of course. They combed the whole area for weeks, but without success."
"Did they ever discover the identity of Marisa's secret admirer?"
"Hmm."
The sad Signora sighed.
"I think the police needed to show some results. The only lead they had was something Marisa told me the day before she disappeared, that she would be meeting her admirer at Femina Morta the following night to clear the air.
Clear the air?
Give him his marching orders.
Well, I thought she wanted to marry him.
Well, yes, but he wasn't her only admirer, and she found him rather weird. Too eccentric, somehow. His love letters were starting to get on her nerves, if only because she found it hard to decipher his handwriting. On top of that, she'd fallen head over heels in love with someone else, a centre-half who played for Calcio Catania, and besides, she was, well, pregnant.
By the footballer?
The sad signora nodded.
Second month.
So that night at Femina Morta,
Poldi summarized,
Marisa intended to give her mysterious admirer the push.
Yes, and return all his letters.
Very romantic of her.
No, the footballer was insanely jealous, that's all.
And who was this mysterious admirer?
Well, her allusion to Femina Morta pointed to the father of your friend Valerie. He came under suspicion and was questioned for days without success. Nothing could be proved against him, but everyone around here, me included, considered him a murderer, because, of course, we realized eventually that Marisa must be dead. Signor Ricci spent the rest of his life trying to refute the suspicion. He bravely lived among us and never avoided people, but at some stage it all became too much for him.
What do you mean?
He killed himself. Didn't you know? Of course, that finally convinced us that he really had murdered Marisa.
Poldi drew a deep breath.
And Marisa's parents?
The tragedy destroyed them. They divorced 2 years later. Marisa's mother died last year. I don't know where her father's living now.
Signora Cocuzzo was looking even sadder than usual.
You ought to tell all this to the police again,
Poldi told her. Signora Cocuzzo shook her head.
What would be the point after all these years? Besides, the police hardly acquitted themselves with glory back then. I got the impression they weren't all that eager to solve the case.
Someone was pulling strings, you mean?
There's no proof, of course.
Russo?
Signora Cocuzzo shrugged her shoulders.
Russo was 19 at the time. He was after Marisa too, of course. In fact, they may even have had a fling. But Russo wasn't stupid. He knew he wasn't good enough for Marisa, not at that stage. And he was stunningly good-looking himself. He could take his pick. Besides, he was too bound up in his first business venture.
Which was?
He dug up some big palm trees on wasteland and sold them to the American air base at Sigonella. It must have been a profitable deal, because he bought his first plot of land and set up Piente Russo soon afterwards.
You mean his career began just after Marisa disappeared?
I mean nothing at all, Donna Poldina. I just can't forget her, that's all. And I thought you might be interested.
Poldi looked at her.
What has all this got to do with Valentino's death?
Another shrug.
From what I hear, Valentino was killed where they found Marisa's body. So her murderer must have killed him too, it's only logical.
Poldi hadn't looked at it like that. Signora Cocuzza's reasoning wasn't particularly forensic, but once it had been voiced its simplicity struck Poldi as being so logical that she could only shake her head in bewilderment.
My dear Signora Cocuzza, do you know something? You're a genius.
Outside, the whiz-bang salutes in honor of the local saint had started up again. The unresolved triviality, too, had perked up. It was standing on its blanket, wagging its tail excitedly and barking at Poldi. All at once, it had something in its mouth. A small, brightly colored toy.
And at that moment,
my aunt told me later, not without a certain self-satisfaction,
everything became clear to me. I knew who had killed Valentino and why,
and I also knew how I might be able to prove it.
Well, go on.
Have you guessed already? What's this supposed to be?
I asked evasively.
An intermediate examination in inductive logic. Just tell me.
But I wouldn't play. I hate tests, and always have. I break out in a sweat even if someone asks me the way in my own hometown. Also, I'm no Sherlock Holmes, and I don't like spoiling other people's stories.
It's your story, I said firmly. You finish it off.
Poldi's train of thought was as follows. Valentino had blackmailed his killer with his knowledge of Marisa's murder. He had probably discovered the body in the cistern, but he must have had further evidence. There had probably been an exchange of evidence for cash at the cistern, but something had gone wrong, badly wrong. Since Valentino's killer had tried to deter Poldi from investigating, vide the dead cat, this could only mean that the evidence must still exist somewhere. Valentino had probably hidden it like the price list under the lion, but where? In his room at his parents' place? Unlikely. Montana's men had searched it thoroughly. At her house, like the lion? That seemed too risky to be very likely. So where? What sort of evidence was it, anyway? Glancing at the unresolved triviality, Poldi had a sudden idea.
How did Marisa get those love letters?
She asked Signora Cocuzza.
By post? Of course not. Her parents would have found out. The couple had a dead letterbox where her admirer left the letters.
Poldi's theory crystallized.
Do you know where this dead letterbox was?
Of course. It was I who had to collect the billet doux for her.
Why doesn't that surprise me, Signora Cocuzza?
The sad signora lowered her eyes a trifle coquettishly, Poldi noticed.
Of course I told the police all this at the time, but the letters had gone. Would you like to see it?
The dead letterbox? You mean it still exists?
Where, in Bavaria and Sicily alike, do people still deposit spare keys, prayer requests, lottery tickets, and secret messages? With the Virgin Mary, of course. Every respectable household possesses a statuette of the Virgin, and old houses even have a small niche to accommodate one. But statues of the Madonna can also be found outside one's own four walls, for instance at crossroads, in fishing ports, taverns, and places in special need of divine protection. A mineral water spring, for example. The patron saint of Torre Acchirafi is the Madonna del Rosario, a blue-robed Madonna with a rosary in her hand. This large figure, which looks so poignant, is stationed beside the altar in the church. A smaller copy can be found in the side wall of the Acqua di Torre mineral water factory, just beside the public bottling taps in an old shrine of volcanic rock and glazed tiles.
The Belfiore family donated it in the 19th century,
Signora Cocuzza informed Poldi on the way there. My aunt noticed that a small stage had been set up in the church square. Banners were hanging from many windows, and the streets were overarched with colourful streamers and festoons. Padre Paolo, who was supervising two youths engaged in setting off another rocket, bade the two women a jovial, "Good day!" Already intent on the shrine, Poldi waved back absently. She knew the little shrine, but had hitherto paid it scant attention. Flush with the wall of the bottling plant, it took the form of a squat tabernacle. Mounted on a small marble base behind a cast-iron grill, the painted plaster Madonna was draped with plastic rosaries and surrounded by votive candles and artificial flowers.
"Ecco," said Signora Cocuzza. "Marissa's admirer had given her a key to the padlock. But you're wondering where the letters were, aren't you?"
Poldi looked closely at the shrine. The lava stone base appeared to be solid, and there was not enough room inside the shrine to secrete a letter, far less a whole bundle.
"Look closer,"
whispered the sad signora. Then Poldi saw it.
Madonna mia! Well, I'll be damned!
She could just make out a fine, rectangular crack in the marble base on which the Madonna stood. The tiny knob of the perfectly fitting stone drawer was concealed by a small vase.
"That's where the Belfiore family used to leave their prayer requests,"
Signora Cocuzza explained.
"They alone possessed a key to the grill."
Poldi examined the padlock, which looked fairly new and displayed no traces of rust.
"Who has the key these days?" "Padre Paolo, and he was kind enough..."
Signora Cocuzza produced a small key from the pocket of her apron and held it under Poldi's nose. No grin, not even a smile. The sad signora was utterly poker-faced. My auntie Poldi was beginning to like her more and more. While the signora kept watch, Poldi opened the grill, pushed the plastic flowers a little to one side, and slid out the small marble drawer beneath the Virgin. Cautiously, but without hesitation, she removed its contents. Then she closed the drawer, rearranged the plastic flowers, and locked the grill again.
"What do you plan to do now?"
asked the sad signora. "Go to the police?" But that was only a half-truth, because Poldi's first step was to go home, spread out her haul on the table in the courtyard, and examine it carefully. Lying in front of her was everything Valentino had been able to secrete in the small drawer. 4 small, pale blue envelopes addressed in ornate handwriting to someone by the name of Diotima, together with a ringlet of dark hair tied up with cheap ribbon. This could only have belonged to Marisa Pulisi, but Poldi was puzzled by the name Diotima on the envelopes. She laid out the 4 letters side by side. Small sheets of very thin paper, neatly folded and written on in the same ornate, almost illegible handwriting. The letters were dated, but the dates were several weeks apart, so Poldi surmised that Valentino had fished them out at random from a bigger pile before hiding them under the Madonna, as a nest egg, so to speak. From the look of them, they consisted of poems with a personal addition at the end, and then, diatima-wise, the penny dropped. Poldi needed no translation. 2 clicks, and she found the original on the internet. The author of the letters had botched up Herdeline's celebrated ode to Diotima and adapted it to his own libidinous requirements. "Thy heavenly bosom me arouses, makes me yearn to play love's game. Slip thy hand inside my trousers, and I to thee will do the same. For Diotima, my goddess of the temple of pleasure, meet me on the mole at 11 tonight. D." "D?" I asked, rather at a loss, when Poldi was revealing the full details of the case.
"Yes, of course. D for Domenico. Domenico Pastorella di Belfiore, a.k.a. Mimi, butcher of Herdeline and double murderer. I mean, I'm no fan of Herdeline's stuff, but that was a really tasteless piece of horseshit."
"Aren't you being too hard on him?" I countered. "The man was besotted, after all, and lovers make monkeys of themselves."
"A fat lot you know about it. At all events, that doggerel of Mimi's gave me an insight into his state of mind. I realized that he must have killed Marisa as well as Valentino, Marisa out of jealousy and wounded vanity, Valentino on account of blackmail."
"I see. And what sparked that revelation?"
"Why, the lion. The lion, get it?"
"The lion?"
"The plastic lion, of course. The toy dog I took from Totti at the mine and threw away. It was exactly like the one Mimi's Doberman is always chewing."
"So what? There must be hundreds of the things."
"Don't be such a smarty-pants. Good God, you've got to admit it couldn't have been a coincidence. That little plastic lion at the mine was quite new. Totti found it near the cistern.
Siston, Plastic Lion, Herdeline, Valentino, Mimi, Bingo. Follow me? It was as clear as daylight.
Then you ought to have called Montana.
Jesus Christ almighty, I wanted to solve the case all by myself, and I still didn't have any solid evidence.
What about a lock of Maurice's hair and maybe some DNA on the letters?
Yes, yes, very clever, Professor. Congratulations. Cento punti. But at that moment, I was in the grip of something.
The hunting instinct?
Now we understand each other.
My Auntie Poldy was one of the most fearless people I know. She wanted a confession, obviously, and that required her to set a little trap for Mimi Pastorella. Summoning up all her courage, she telephoned Mimi and informed him, politely but point-blank, that she had established his guilt and could prove it. She would, however, be prepared to keep her mouth shut and hand over all her evidence if Mimi were willing to pay her an appropriate quid pro quo of 50,000 euros, which she needed in order to renovate her roof. Giving the startled man no time to respond or prevaricate, Poldy invited him to settle the matter at the Via Baronessa that same night, or she would take her evidence to the police. Then she hung up. 50,000 euros for her leaky roof struck Poldy as an affordable but realistic sum, for which it wouldn't be worth committing a third murder. She estimated that if Mimi consented to the deal, it would be tantamount to a confession. She prepared to document their meeting in a thoroughly professional manner by attaching a tape recorder to the underside of her sofa table with sticky tape. She also loaded the Bavarian infantry musket and propped it up against the sofa, well within view, in case Mimi showed up with a sawn-off lupada.
"Just a moment," I broke in at that point. "I thought the old blunderbuss was unusable.
Officially deactivated and so on."
Poldy sighed. "Of course not. My father never collected any useless weapons."
I stared uneasily at the muskets and pistols hanging on the opposite wall.
"You mean they're all,
potentially lethal?"
"They're all in working order, let's say." "All right, I admit there was a certain risk involved, because it's a muzzle loader and they aren't easy to load. You have to take care. But in the first place, my old man showed me how, and secondly, I didn't load a bullet, just a small powder charge with a wad of paper on top, understand?"
"You simply wanted to make a big bang, right?"
"Dead right, Professor. I wanted to be prepared for all eventualities, leave nothing to chance. It was all planned in an ultra-professional way."
But, as is the way with plans that leave nothing to chance, my Auntie Poldy found herself in a tight spot. For what she hadn't taken into account, or criminally neglected, one might also say, was the fact that the festival in honour of the Madonna del Rosario, Torre Achirafi's patron saint, was taking place on that of all nights. In addition to whiz-bangs all day long, this included a grand firework display in the evening, a church service, and an ensuing religious procession through the streets, and a party for the young people of Torre with a band from Riposto. In other words, the usual thing where a town's patron saint was concerned. People splashed out on such occasions, especially when they lived beside the sea and needed protection from tempests and tidal waves. The whole of Torre Achirafi was out and about. Summoned by bells and whiz-bangs, everyone was flocking into the church. And that, stupidly enough, meant there were no neighbours within hailing distance. Mimi turned up on the dot, impeccably dressed as ever in a three-piece suit, and accompanied by Herdeline. The dog was something else Poldy hadn't considered, and no wonder, alas, because she was slightly tipsy by the time Mimi arrived. In spite of all her good resolutions, she had already downed a stiff one for her nerve's sake. Not exactly the best preparation for such a crucial encounter, but that was my Auntie Poldy. Mimi appeared to be unarmed, though. He certainly hadn't brought a lupara with him. Poldy initially hesitated to invite the old gentleman and his Doberman inside. She wondered whether she shouldn't simply slam the front door and call Montana. Although she might have been better advised to, she pulled herself together.
Stepping aside, she ushered Herdaline and his master into the house. Mimi surveyed his surroundings while Herdaline took off on his own, roaming around and sniffing like a cop with a search warrant, or a professional killer.
"You have a nice house, Donna Isolde, but you say the roof needs fixing already? That certainly wouldn't have happened in Germany. You might have done better to stay there."
Poldi ignored this.
"A glass of wine, Don Mimi?"
"Very civil of you, Donna Isolde, but no thanks."
"A coke? Some water?"
"No, please don't bother."
"I trust you won't object if I pour myself a glass?"
"Well, of course not, Donna Isolde."
Mimi was playing the respectable signore, a man of integrity from his gout-ridden toe to his few remaining wisps of hair, his voice soft and tremulous. He looked somewhat more bent back than usual, more preoccupied, too. And no wonder, thought Poldi, when you've done such things and carried a burden of guilt around with you for decades, and now everything threatens to blow up in your face. On the other hand, she thought he looked surprisingly calm.
"An heirloom of your father's, I gather,"
Mimi said softly, pointing to the musket propped against the sofa.
"Ah, yes, it needed cleaning. Please."
Poldi nervously indicated an armchair. Without taking his eyes off my aunt, Mimi sank back against the cushions and clicked his fingers. Herdaline came trotting up and sat down obediently at his side. Poldi noticed with a touch of uneasiness that the Doberman, too, was eyeing her fixedly. She sat down on the edge of the sofa, pushed the musket aside, and poured herself another scotch. Her hand was trembling, and she hoped the recording machine beneath the table between her and Mimi was picking up every word.
"I had honestly hoped we could be friends, Donna Isolde."
Poldi refused to be intimidated.
"Friends don't leave dead cats outside each other's doors."
Mimi made a dismissive gesture.
"What does a cat matter? A dog, on the other hand."
He fondled Herdaline's head.
"A dog is a divine creature, and closer to man than any other, woman included."
"Really? I think you must have got the wrong end of the stick in biology or religious education."
A touch of annoyance furrowed Mimi's brow, but he recovered himself at once.
"Well, now, about these outrageous accusations of yours."
"Which I can prove, Don Mimi. You killed Valentino Candela, and, 40 years ago, Marisa Puglisi."
Another feeble, dismissive gesture.
"In that case, would you kindly show me this alleged evidence of my alleged guilt?"
"Do you have something for me, too?"
Another sigh. Mimi felt in his breast pocket and brought out a wad of 500 euro notes. He fanned them out on the table.
"Want to count them?"
"That won't be necessary."
Poldi took a padded envelope from under a sofa cushion, extracted the four letters and the lock of hair, and put them down beside the money. Mimi nodded.
"Ah, the lock of hair. I knew Valentino still had it. If you hadn't included it, I wouldn't have trusted you."
"These are all the letters I found. I don't think Valentino had any more."
"No. I had to burn the others, alas."
"Before or after you shot him?"
This was precisely the moment at which Poldi meant to begin her rigorous interrogation. Unfortunately, events took a different turn. For one thing, the Madonna del Rosario procession set off from the church square to a deafening accompaniment of whiz-bangs, tolling bells, and universal pandemonium. For another, Mimi was startled into dropping his senile romantics pose. Seemingly jolted out of a pleasant daydream into vile reality, he stared at Poldi for a moment as if realizing for the first time who he was up against.
Quick as a flash, more nimbly than Poldi would have believed, and before she herself could react, he snatched up the letters and the lock of hair. Then he shouted,
"Herdaline, attack!"
In German, mark you. Herdaline needed no second bidding. He seemed to have been waiting for that moment, and no wonder,
after a life spent worrying cashmere sweaters, terry towels, and plastic lions, and occasionally, perhaps, being allowed to inflict an experimental bite on the leg of a Moroccan manservant or the arm of a clumsy child in the Corso. He hadn't even been permitted to touch Valentino, because that would have left telltale marks. So it was only understandable that Herdaline's innocent Doberman psyche had developed a certain pent-up pressure, a bloodlust fantasy, a war cry of the wild which he now obeyed with alacrity. In response to Mimi's command, and without any superfluous barking or growling, he flew at my Auntie Poldy. It was nothing personal. Herdaline was a pro. My aunt, on the other hand, was somewhat short-winded and not as quick on her pins as she used to be. Nor, as already mentioned, was she entirely sober. Situations of this kind are eternally surprising, however, for she reacted with undreamt-of matrix-like agility, as if time had slowed down for her. "I saw Herdaline spring at me in slow motion," she told me later. "It was like my last hour had come and I'd entered another space-time continuum." Be that as it may, a person's reflexes take over at such moments. Poldy spun round, grabbed the musket, and, while Herdaline was still in mid-air, clouted him on the head. The Doberman uttered a yelp and landed with a crash on the coffee table. There was another crash as the old musket simultaneously went off. The powder charge erupted from the muzzle with plenty of smoke and flame, blowing a hole in the ceiling and generating a recoil that tore the weapon from Poldy's grasp. Profoundly shocked by both occurrences, the crash and the detonation, Mimi shied like a startled horse, then froze. Although the blow with the musket had not been enough to put Herdaline completely out of action, it did at least gain Poldy some time. Still moving with unwanted agility, she dived over the back of the sofa and ran up the stairs to the roof, a typically irrational thing to do because she could easily have reached the front door instead. That, however, would have entailed dodging past Mimi and the dazed Doberman, which formed a kind of optical psychological barrier. Meanwhile, Mimi unfroze and Herdaline scrambled to his feet. "After her!" Breathing heavily, Poldy reached the roof terrace.
"Help! Help!"
But no one could hear her. Everyone in town was joining in the procession. Skyrockets, brass band, and fervent singing combined to produce a din that reverberated around the streets and rose into the night sky, which was tinged with a glow of torches and candles.
"Help!"
Not a chance. Poldy briefly considered escaping onto Dottore Branciforti's roof terrace like Turi, but didn't think she was up to it. So there she stood, all alone on her expansive roof, feeling rather frightened because Herdaline, overwrought and still slightly dazed, appeared a moment later. That he bore her an unmistakable grudge was evident from the way he herded her towards the parapet overlooking the street. Mimi, who came toiling up the stairs after him, left Poldy in no doubt as to how the night would end.
"Germany is such a lovely country, Donna Isolde. Why couldn't you have stayed there? Why did you have to poke your nose into things that don't concern you?"
"It's an old failing of mine,"
Poldy gasped, with Herdaline's slavering muzzle inches from her face. He had both forepaws planted on her chest, as though he meant to push her off the roof, and her supposition to that effect was probably correct.
"How did Valentino get hold of the letters and the lock of hair?"
she called to Mimi, more to gain time than for information's sake.
"Pure chance. I had an arrangement with Patanay concerning the, exploitation of my various properties. That was how Valentino must have come across the letters. I had mentioned Femina Morta to Marisa in the last one I wrote her. Valentino put two and two together and looked around a mine. He saw me throw a rose into the cistern on the anniversary of Marisa's death."
"How romantic!"
"I didn't kill Marisa," Mimi snapped. "It was an accident. She meant to leave me for that footballer. She wouldn't even keep my letters, the silly girl."
"That doesn't surprise me somehow."
"Hold your tongue. I worshipped Marisa. It was an accident.
She was so scared by Herdaline the First, she staggered backwards and hit her head on the side of the cistern.
You could have explained all that to the police?
The police were the least of my worries. It was a scandal. You didn't know my father. He would have torn me to pieces and disinherited me.
A pity he didn't.
And so, with a bleeding heart, I laid my goddess, my Diatima, to rest in there, hoping to preserve our love and our secret for all time.
You simply dumped her down there like rubbish.
Mimi was growing calmer. He peered over the parapet. Then, serenity personified, he stepped back.
Believe me, Donna Isolde, everyone in town will mourn your death. I shall contribute a wreath and recite some poems by the master at your funeral. It will be extremely moving.
No, don't go to any trouble,
gasped Poldi.
Mimi shook his head.
No one will be surprised, Donna Isolde. The drinking, the depression, the foreign country. No wonder you longed for death like a far-off, unattainable lover. That's what people will think.
Thus spake the romantic in him. Then he turned prosaically pragmatic.
And now, Donna Isolde, you have a choice. Either you jump of your own free will, or Herdaline will assist you by tearing your face off.
Can I phone a friend?
Poldi gasped bravely. Mimi was infuriated.
Go on! Jump, Herdaline!
Herdaline snapped at Poldi's throat, and she shrank back even further over the parapet, unable to go much further. She pictured Death getting out his ballpoint and preparing to strike her name from the list on his funny clipboard. Behind her, the Madonna del Rosario procession was still blaring its way through the town at a snail's pace. She estimated that it would take another 20 minutes to reach the Via Baronessa. 20 minutes too long, alas.
And that's why Valentino had to die?
He wanted €200,000.
My God, Mimi, why didn't you simply pay him off?
All Valentino wanted was to get out of Sicily.
You'd never have heard from him again.
The swine didn't give me all the letters or the lock of hair at our first meeting. He'd have gone on blackmailing me forever.
That was why he called Valentino on Valerie's phone and summoned him to Femina Morta for a final payment. At their second meeting, he'd wasted no time in setting Herdaline on him the way he had once set Herdaline's predecessor on Marisa and was now menacing my Auntie Poldi. Then he had cold-bloodedly fired a load of buckshot at Valentino's face, loaded him into the boot of Patanè's car, driven him back to Torre, and laid him out on the beach at Priola.
Why didn't you simply dump him in the cistern?
Beside Marisa? Never. No one was going to lie beside Marisa.
Maybe that was your big mistake.
That's enough. Jump, or Herdaline will do it for you.
Herdaline came even closer. His breath stank of tartar and rotting meat. Poldi shrank back further still. Behind her, only 30 feet of thin air separated her from the potholed surface of the Via Baronessa. Not far away, the brass band leading the procession was blaring out a slow march. End of the line. Death was impatiently fiddling with his ballpoint. And then Etna erupted. Etna is regarded as a good-natured volcano, whose lava is low in gas content and relatively inexplosive, and it regularly releases its internal pressure. A stream of lava will flatten a village once in a blue moon, it's true, and half of Catania was destroyed in the 17th century. But everything happens nice and slowly, so there's always time to clear out the salotto, tie the children's shoelaces, drink a coffee, and watch the catastrophe from a safe distance. In any case, the lava tends to run down into the uninhabited Valle del Bove, of which Poldi's terrace affords an excellent view. Good-natured or not, though, when Etna does erupt, it transfixes you. The mountain with a picturesque plume of smoke then becomes a gigantic living creature that roars abruptly like a furious old man roused too soon from his siesta. The air quivers with each eruption, galvanizing one's nerves and imagination. Just such a roar, a gigantic boom,
issuing from the bowels of the earth, rent the air behind me, went thundering through the salty night air, rolled down the slopes, surged over tranquil Torre Akirafi and its bitter